Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Coast Guard is saying that BP has successfully sliced off that bent pipe attached to the gushing Gulf well, but the cut is irregular, so capping it today to siphon off the oil is difficult. Made more difficult for BP engineers, perhaps, because the whole world is watching. But could some of those people watching actually have a better idea? Innocentive is a company that uses crowdsourcing to work on difficult problems. That means they have a network of 200,000 experts. They throw out problems to them and see who comes up with the best solutions. They're called solvers. And they are taking a look at the Gulf. So let's spend a couple of minutes with Innocentive President and CEO Dwayne Spradlin. Dwayne, start with this capping attempt. What is your network of experts saying?
They're very hopeful that the capping approach is the right approach to take. But there's also been a fair amount of frustration from the network that there were known issues with things like crystallization and ultimately what BP ran into that should have been taken into account.
This was the fact that it was cold, and so there was this crystallization. The very first cap they tried to put over, they couldn't. Now they're talking about warming things up down there, but they're only talking about this as a stopgap, as a siphoning measure, not as a complete plug. Are you hearing from scientists who still think it can be plugged?
I think there's still a lot of hope that it can be plugged. I think the network is coming up with ideas every day to use everything from, you know, powerful neodymium magnets to plug it to actually pinching the pipe shut using different kinds of technologies, including explosive hydroforming.
And it was a former oil rig worker who suggested pinching the pipe shut.
Well, that's right. A number from the oil exploration industry in particular have noted that there are many conventional technologies that with certain modifications could probably pinch this thing shut entirely. And that also gets to the one of the solutions I mentioned a few minutes ago, explosive hydroforming, which is also in that category of pinching this pipe shut, which said with a set of controlled explosions, you could literally create a force imbalance and shape the force around the piping itself and close it just like you would a hand, but do that with explosives at these massive pressures.
Well, others are talking about explosives, but, you know, then you get into the questions of what else you do down there in the sea. Although, if we're heading for, you know, a disaster on the level of dead zones, maybe it's worth the risk. But I want to find out what some more of your solvers, these are the scientists who send in potential solutions, what they're suggesting for containing the damage.
There's been fascinating solutions coming in, running the gamut from using organic materials to create almost a natural kind of gel material, to some very recently that we think are particularly exciting. One is using barges, and that using very high-strength material, literally drop a drape from the barges and create a line of these to hold off the oil flow from hitting the shore until it can be collected. Another phenomenal idea that we have is what we call the giant funnel idea. And what this says is use the material not unlike what you see at Denver Airport, if you've ever been through there. It's a very thick, high-strength material designed to handle wind speeds of over 100 miles an hour, and literally create an upside-down funnel drape around the pipe floor in the bottom and extend it all the way to the surface.
Well, and there's also a hotline, but it sounds as if you've gathered, you know, really the top minds. Are you able to get through to BP?
Well, you know, let me first say that I can't imagine that anybody's busier right now or wants this thing solved more than British Petroleum. I mean, we know that. But what they need to do is they need to engage these global communities of creative thinkers and engineers and scientists, and they need to challenge them with the specifics and the real data of what's happening on the floor.
In other words, give out more information than, in fact, in some cases they have. Some people have been critical of BP, but you say at this point, what, it's beyond proprietary. They need to share it.
It is. This problem is not BP's any longer. It belongs to all of us. It's interesting. When we offer these solutions around the world, we're generally doing it with what we call a bounty or a prize, $5,000, $50,000, $1 million to the top solutions. This is the first challenge we've ever run with no prize at all. And what we have had here are literally thousands of top-notch thinkers submitting their ideas, diagrams, solutions for this problem for no financial remuneration at all. They're doing it because they're passionate about solving the problem. What we think BP needs to do is really to, you know, allocate a small percentage of its team to focusing on engaging people elsewhere in the world and coming up with new solutions, because I think the traditional rules and the playbook that they take at an oil spill isn't working in this situation. They desperately need new ideas.
Drane Spradlin, president and CEO of Innocentives, a company that uses crowdsourcing to work on difficult problems. They've thrown out the problem in the Gulf to hundreds of thousands of scientists, and they're going to compile and rate them and try to send them on to the White House and BP. Dwayne, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
An international manhunt is underway for Joran Vandersloot, who's accused, or suspected rather, of killing Alabama teenager Natalie Holloway 5 years ago in Aruba, and is now suspected of killing another woman last weekend in Peru. Well, this won't come as a surprise to a mother we'll meet in a few minutes. Her daughter was murdered by an ex-boyfriend who later killed another woman he was dating. Dating violence. We want to take a look at it today. The Justice Department says young women have the highest incidence of domestic or dating violence. Stalking is up on college campuses. And, of course, there was University of Virginia lacrosse player Yardley Love, allegedly killed by her boyfriend. The group Break the Cycle recently gave Virginia a failing grade because it's one of 8 states that does not allow someone in a dating relationship to obtain a restraining order through police. We want to find out more. Marjorie Gilberg is Executive Director of Break the Cycle. And Marjorie, you studied states looking specifically at avenues that young people have to get protection for themselves, including civil protection orders, which are different from criminal restraining orders?
That's correct. We are looking specifically at protection orders as they are available to minors and people in dating relationships. And civil protection orders in this instance are defined by an individual citizen pursuing a protection order against another individual citizen.
And so with a civil protection order, you can go in and request it as opposed to the criminal, in which case you have to file charges against someone.
Right. That's exactly right.
Okay. What'd you find? How many states allow minors who are in dating situations to file for protection?
Well, minors have access to protection orders at some level in 45 states and in the District of Columbia. Missouri is the only state that explicitly does not allow minors to access protection orders unless a person is married. We also assessed in the report card whether or not the state has statutes that address requiring education around this issue and whether or not young people have access to sensitive services that may be required in order for them to address an abusive situation.
But then the question is raised, would they? Here in Massachusetts, the Boston Globe recently highlighted a terrible spate, 8 domestic homicides in 1 month, but the youngest, a 19-year-old Fitchburg State College student whose boyfriend is accused of killing her, he'd become controlling. Police had urged her to take out an order against him. She eventually did, but went to see her boyfriend, and he allegedly killed her. Isn't there something that makes this particularly difficult with young people?
I think abusive relationships are complicated for anyone that is in an abusive relationship. The issues of power and control can be very confusing. There aren't a lot of people who are willing to step in and advise and assist and really support, especially a young person who may be in this situation. And often the abuse within dating relationships sometimes isn't taken as seriously as the abuse in adult domestic violence situations. And we know from the news of late, especially, it is just as serious and requires the same sort of protections that adults have.
Yeah, but you go further than looking at the states. You say that the schools have responsibility too. Yardley Love, as we said, was at the University of Virginia. But UVA has a trial system in which students are required to confront their abusers before a committee of their peers. So it sounds as if the school was offering an avenue to young women in particular who may not want to, you know, go to the police.
Yeah, I think one of the major concerns, though, is that universities understandably have set up most of their response systems to deal with sexual assault on campus. Unfortunately, acquaintance rape is not the same thing as a long-term abusive relationship where there may be a lot more complicated, systemic, long-term controlling, stalking issues, and that setting up a response protocol that only responds to one type of incident on campus is not going to be the answer.
In fact, you've and others have said that the trial system may make young women more vulnerable, put them in more danger.
Absolutely, especially when you're in a relationship with someone who is well-liked, popular, athletic, handsome. There's a lot of risk for someone to go before a jury of peers to defend herself around an issue of abuse. And really, that's not how it should be done.
Well, we know that some states are changing their laws to allow protection orders for dating couples. Almost all of the laws, though, are for opposite-sex couples, right? There's even fewer protection for same-sex couples.
There are some states where it's explicit that it has to be an opposite-sex couple. A lot of states sort of just avoid that language, and so it's not clear, and it's left up to a court or a particular judge to decide whether or not it's going to be applied. It's why the laws need to be explicit about are dating partners included, are minors protected, are same-sex couples protected.
But in the meantime, are states starting to pass laws that would at least mandate dating violence education?
There are a handful of states that have laws in place that require dating violence education to be taught in schools. I believe there are five now. Nebraska, Rhode Island, Texas, and ironically, Virginia have those laws. And Florida's just passed. And I believe Ohio had one passed recently, too. So there may be six states now.
Yeah. What kind of role does the internet play in all of this?
Because young people use technology as a primary form of communication, emails, cell phone texting, inevitably, those are just more tools for people to use to exert power and control over their victims. So it's not to say that technology is not a factor. It's just that it's just one more way someone can be abusive.
Well, the Justice Department reports that 17% of teens said they were afraid to not respond to an abusive partner's cell phone call or email or text message because they were afraid of what they might do. So they find themselves communicating, whereas there might have been a time where you could get away, but now you can't get away from text messages. So is this a situation that you think is growing? I'm reading we have so many groups. There's the Lindsay Ann Burke Memorial Fund, that there's a Kristen Mitchell Foundation, there's Deanna's Educational Theater, all groups that have been set up by families of murdered daughters. Is this something that is growing, or are we just not covering it up as much? What would you say?
Certainly awareness about dating abuse and the seriousness of it and the potential severity of it is much more prominent now than it was even 10 years ago. It's only been a few years now that the Violence Against Women Act has even had inclusive legislation about dating violence. And now that we know what we call it and we can name it, I think there's going to be a lot more opportunity for us to actually connect the dots.
Marjorie Gilbert, one last thing. What advice would you give to parents or friends who can see that a young person's in an abusive relationship? We read these stories, parents pleading with their daughters. What advice can you give?
Thank you for asking that question. The most important thing that a parent or friend can do is be supportive of the person who's being abused, that this isn't a choose us or choose him situation, because if that's the case and your son or daughter's in an abusive relationship, inevitably they're going to end up having to choose the abuser.
Marjorie Gilbert, executive director of the advocacy group Break the Cycle. They grade states on partner abuse laws and protections. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Marjorie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And just ahead, the woman who set up the first support group after her daughter was murdered by an ex-boyfriend back in the 70s. We'll hear from her. But let us hear from you as well if you have thoughts on this or anything on the program. Again, you can go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us to send an email, or leave a comment right there on the homepage, hereandnow.org. Back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about teen dating violence. Let's bring in Charlotte Hullinger, who founded the inconceivable group Parents of Murdered Children in Cincinnati back in 1978 after her daughter Lisa was murdered by her ex-boyfriend at a school in Germany. Now, I happened to be in her living room taping when Charlotte held her first meeting. I remember thinking, there can't be enough parents of murdered children in this nice town to fill this room up. But in they came. We tracked Charlotte down. She's on the line. Charlotte?
Robin?
How nice to hear your voice.
I am so glad our paths are crossing again, and I remember that meeting.
Well, I want to ask you about that. Do you remember, first of all, how that felt back then to see your living room fill up?
Oh, I do indeed. And, of course, I remember the way I felt when I first got back from Germany and we buried Lisa. people didn't want to talk about it, and I was just supposed to sort of get over it, and I figured out I need to talk to somebody who's been through it, somebody who can tell me what to expect. And I searched and I searched and I searched. Americans are fascinated by murders and murderers, but not by the families of the people who are killed.
Well, and you found, you found your own group and found other parents. How have you reacted when, you know, all these decades later, it's still happening?
Well, I don't think we ever believed that we could prevent murder. But we did want to increase the awareness of what the effects are, this terrible sense of loneliness.
Well, and you could say another result of you not being listened to was that it happened again. This was incredible to hear. I didn't know this until yesterday, but William Coday, who murdered your daughter in 1978, murdered another girl?
That's right. He spent 15 months in a German jail.
That's all, 15 months for killing your daughter?
That's right. And he came back. He went to law school and got his law degree, was twice married.
And that brings us up to 1997.
He met this girl who was from Colombia, and she changed her mind, just as Lisa had changed her mind about dating Bill as she got to know him better.
Your daughter, yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she broke off. Well, Gloria also broke off, but he doesn't react well to girls who break off their relationship with him. And so he made up this lie that he was suffering from cancer, and he wanted to talk to her just one more time when she come over to the house. She went over. He inflicted 144 stab wounds and beat her with two hammers.
So the young man who murdered your daughter murders again. You went to the 2002 Fort Lauderdale trial.
Yes, I did. And the jury was not allowed to hear what he had done to Lisa. It just angered me so much that the law would not permit the fact that he had murdered another woman in precisely the same way to be presented to the jury. Nope, yeah. Couldn't hear it.
William Coday was sentenced to death in 2002. He committed suicide in 2008 while on Florida's death row.
That's what I understand.
Charlotte, I mean, you say you didn't want to stop murder. You knew you couldn't stop murders. But I'm sure you thought maybe you could,
stop one murderer.
Yeah. And I mean, again, what do you think now when you see the stories that we see today? Do you think people still don't want to believe it could happen?
That's a tough question. The evidence is all around us that it can happen and does happen, and yet we like to think of crime victims and criminals as being something that happens in another part of town, and there's still some of that thinking.
Do you have any advice for parents today? Again, your daughter had broken up with the man who became her murderer. We see that happening in other cases today.
I was really thinking about that after I see that you're having this other speaker and trying to prevent this kind of thing from happening. And I asked myself, how could this possibly have been prevented, which, of course, is the question every parent asks after the murder of their child. What could I, should I have done to prevent it? I don't know. We've dealt with many, many instances of this in parents of murdered children. And there have been cases where they get, you know, an order of protection. Does it help? Not often. It's usually just violated. Does it help to break up with the person? That's what Lisa did. Breaking off the relationship did not deter what happened to them afterwards. How can you say to your children, don't get involved with anybody that you think might turn out to be like this? I mean, Bill Coday was a bright, likable person, and we had him in our home. If the person gets too possessive, you know, they tend to cut off contact, try to isolate the person. I guess we've learned a little bit more about the profile of the abuser, and maybe that means if the woman recognizes those signals a little bit earlier, maybe she can separate herself from that person. I guess about all I've learned is just really be aware of the person that you're dating. I'm very cautious about anybody who does computer dating and online dating.
And are you encouraged by the fact that colleges are starting to recognize this?
Yes. I think more education never hurts. Getting to know ourselves better. Why am I drawn to this person? But one definitive or a 1-2-3 formula, I don't have.
That's Charlotte Hollinger. She founded the Parents of Murdered Children, a support group and advocacy organization in Cincinnati after her daughter, Lisa, was murdered in 1978 by an ex-boyfriend. Charlotte, it was so nice to talk to you again.
It was nice talking to you too, Robin.
Okay. And by the way, one of Parents of Murdered Children's new initiatives is the Murder is Not Entertainment Project to try to end the portrayal of murder as entertainment. We'll link you to them at our website, hereandnow.org. Latest news is next, Here and Now. This year, a lot of business school commencements have shifted focus from amassing wealth to attaining morals. Here's investment manager Robert Capito speaking to the Wharton School of Business's 2010 MBA class.
What part do you want to play in the future business community? Will you be proud of yourselves when you look in the mirror? Will it really be by the money you amassed, the accomplishments you have achieved, or the integrity you have displayed in attaining your goals?
Well, that may be boilerplate commencement speech, but it might also be a change in direction. And if so, it comes at a good time because there aren't as many top-paying jobs for MBAs out there. A master's in business administration, the coveted MBA, has long been viewed as a fast track to the top. But Diana Middleton of the Wall Street Journal reports that graduates may be confronting a very different landscape. She joins us now. And Diana, what has been the employment fate of MBA grads in the past, and how has that changed because of the recession?
Well, the interesting thing is that in robust years, it's not uncommon for more than 90% of graduates to have job offers by graduation. This often happens because internships are usually kind of the precursor to getting that job offer. And as far as 2009 and to a certain extent 2010 graduates, it varies by school. But for example, I think it was at NYU, 76% had a job offer at graduation. And again, that is a decline from what it would have been during a healthier time.
Well, and is it bouncing back this year?
The recruiters that I've spoken to, as well as those who direct the career services for MBA students, they say that investment management is bouncing back. Consumer goods is seeing some growth. The other thing that I've noticed that is growing significantly is those positions that are management rotations. These are typically, maybe three-year-long commitments where the graduate is placed within one section of the company and they go from place to place. So they might be doing HR, they might be doing operations, they might be doing business development. That has seen a big increase, mostly because companies slashed a lot of their middle management during this recession, and these rotational programs are a way to build up that pipeline.
So rotational hiring is something that grads can look forward to. And we understand, we're reading articles in the Economist, that this isn't just happening in the U.S. In Britain, the financial markets are also down in hiring.
As far as my knowledge of those jobs abroad, one thing that I did notice is that more students are opting. This is, of course, anecdotal, but more students are opting for jobs abroad. It seems as if the salaries over there, they weren't that high. They weren't high enough for people to justify moving across, the globe. And now those really are significantly improving. So people are willing to go abroad more often now.
You write about Duke University's Fuqua School of Business, and they say they've seen a growth in hiring from companies based overseas. Mm-hmm. With that in mind, are people talking about changing what students are taught, maybe teach them more global finance?
Yes, global focus and an international focus is becoming increasingly important. Schools are making huge strides, many of them requiring students to do projects or consulting work abroad. It really is becoming very, very ingrained. In addition, many European and Asian business schools are saying that they're seeing a huge uptick in American students going over there to get their MBAs. Schools like INSEAD, which is a business school that has campuses in both France and Singapore. Because of that, built-in international global component, those are becoming more attractive to American students.
Well, meantime, What are some of the jobs that MBAs are taking that you've heard of while they wait to get on that fast track?
The people that I've spoken to, I mean, if they don't have a job, you know, they don't have a job. But I haven't heard of anybody going to work at the mall or anything like that. I think most people are kind of waiting it out, but they're just getting a little nervous.
In fact, you say that they're having to resort to the same kind of job search techniques that most people do. I mean, MBAs have always had the benefit of the school-led recruiting effort. They bring the recruiters to the schools. But you say that many of them are now out networking like everybody else.
That's correct. Typically, recruiting season was organized. It was very, you know, routine. Now, with companies scaling back their recruiting efforts, they're not doing as many campus visits. Students themselves have to become very aggressive, and it's not just going on LinkedIn. They really have to do a lot of plumbing of the alumni. They have to really dig into their own personal networks. People are going to have to be very, very creative in order to flag the attention, since it is such a saturated marketplace right now.
Dana Middleton of the Wall Street Journal, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a very brief break, and up next, Coyotes Among Us. That's in about 30 seconds, here and now. Before the 1950s, there were no coyotes east of the Mississippi. Now there are hundreds of thousands of them on the East Coast, often right in people's backyards, where they've been known to nab a pet or two, which has led some folks in Rhode Island to start tracking coyotes. So what did they find? Tom Horton is an environmental journalist. He wrote about coyotes in the Boston Globe Sunday magazine this past weekend. Tom, first of all, how did coyotes even end up on the East Coast?
Basically, they filled that niche that we always say nature abhors a vacuum. We created a vacuum over a couple centuries. Settlers cut off the forests, exterminated most of the wolves and mountain lions. The forests have come back. New England's got more forests than it did 150 years ago. But there were no predators in it. The wolves were pretty much gone. Coyotes, by the way, don't coexist too well with wolves. Wolves like to eat them. So the coyotes, basically, there's this whole eastern U.S. with habitat with no top predator, and they began to fill it. And they sort of came through the northern part of the eastern U.S. in the 30s, and in the 60s, another big push down south. And we've probably got virtually every county of every state east of the Mississippi now has had coyote sightings, including islands off Cape Cod, some of the coastal beaches. They're pretty much everywhere now.
Well, then what's the potential problem? How dangerous are they?
The chances of being bitten or mauled by a dog are far, far, far higher than coyote. There have been relatively few coyote attacks in the U.S., including the West, where there's been a lot of coyotes as long as there have been humans. So not too dangerous. What can make them dangerous is when humans feed them. We actually had a rather troubling incident in Nova Scotia. This is very rare. Last fall, a woman hiker, I think she was 19, was attacked and killed by two coyotes. That almost never happens. They apparently were fed. Usually that just leads them to bite humans. But basically, once a coyote gets used to handouts, most biologists agree that coyote has got to be shot or trapped or taken out of the population.
So it's very rare that a coyote will attack a human. But suddenly what you had in different areas here, as you write, people's pets being mauled, you have people worried about whether or not they can keep free-range chickens, coyotes appearing in increasing numbers in the Newport, Rhode Island area. And then we start almost a detective story. You have biologist Noomi Mitchell, who sets out to find out what's going on, why are there so many packs of coyotes. She launches a massive study with money donated by someone who lost their dog. What did she do?
What Noomi did, and she got funding from the Prince Charitable Trust. Diana and Freddie Prince, who are longtime Newporters, had their small Jack Russell was eaten by a coyote. After they got over wanting to wipe out all the coyotes, they thought, well, what could we do to really find out what the problem is and how to solve it? So they funded Noomi Mitchell to put very expensive GPS collars on coyotes in 10 packs. And she has been able for 5-6 years now to track literally hourly the movements of 10 packs of coyotes. It's the most comprehensive and intimate view we've ever had, probably, of how wild animals are interacting with humans in a densely settled, heavily touristed area. It's kind of Newport from a coyote's point of view, which is very different than most views.
Right. She starts seeing the world through their eyes, which is through the GPS readings. And she would look for things, which she called the mountains, which is where she saw packs congregating. They'd show up as sort of this mountain.
Exactly. Her software could turn these GPS locations into three dimensions. And where you saw a mountain peak, that's where there's lots of readouts. And there would be a mountain, the prince's next door neighbors. It turned out they were feeding coyotes because they thought they were cool, and they immediately stopped when she pointed this out. On a farm where someone's Holstein cow, that's thousands of pounds of meat, died and it was too cold to bury it. Another mountain where well-meaning people are feeding feral cats. Another mountain. They come in, they eat the cat food, and occasionally they eat the cats if they run out of cat food. Deer hunters leaving deer guts in the woods after they gut their kill and haul it out. All these human subsidies, in effect. And of course, the one that was the most concern was it turned out kids in the Parkholm housing development in Newport were feeding these coyotes. You know, they just thought they were cool animals, and Numi was seeing a big mountain there, and that was real trouble.
Well, and as you write, you know, there's a little boy who tells her, this biologist who tracks down this reading from her GPS, arrives at the housing complex, sees that kids are feeding these coyotes because they don't have pets of their own.
That's right. And he tells Numi, he says, oh, I will take care of them. You don't need to worry. Well, indeed he did, until winter came and it lost its interest and the kids went inside. And by then, the coyotes had gotten used to the handouts. They had abandoned their hunting territory. All on GPS, they try to move back into their hunting territory, which is around the Newport Naval Base. Another pack has moved in, taken over. They can't get back in. They're in trouble. It's winter. They got no hunting territory. They start wandering into Newport, harassing dogs on leashes. One gets shot. The pups get euthanized. And this is all the result of kids doing something they thought was taking care of coyotes. And in a way, they were taking care of them.
So the moral of the story, in order to exist or coexist peacefully with coyotes, stop feeding them.
Yeah, exactly. But coyotes can coexist nicely. They are wonderful at catching mice and rats and voles and moles and things like that, that we would like to keep a lid on their numbers. They can do just fine without human subsidies, and they will do that. They will maintain lower populations. It's when they get some human food supply on top of what they can get themselves that their populations start to go up. So we're talking this article about how to coexist with coyotes. We could have just as well labeled this article why we have to coexist with coyotes. I mean, they're here. They're part of the American landscape. It's going to be fascinating to see, you know, how it all settles out. Will they start to really prey on deer? Maybe they're beginning to. All these geese that don't migrate that are a nuisance, will they begin to eat more of them? I mean, we don't know. We're learning, and the coyotes are learning.
Tom Horton, environmental journalist, he wrote about the explosion in the number of coyotes in the New England area in the Boston Globe Sunday magazine. Tom, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Why can't that bad call that robbed Detroit pitcher Armando Galarraga of his perfect game be reversed? Umpire Jim Joyce called a Cleveland runner safe. We could all see he was out, but baseball only has tape replays on home runs, so the umpire couldn't see until later and apologized. You kind of feel bad for him. But let's take a minute to ask Nick Cafardo, national baseball writer for the Boston Globe, why can't this be reversed? Now, the league is deciding whether to review this, but geez, you know, why can't they just reverse it?
Well, I suppose they could, Robin. I just think they've created a system where they have umpires, and they realize that umpires aren't going to get 100% of the calls correct. Unfortunately, this was such a big call, and it really cost this guy, who may never pass this way again, a chance for immortality. But I'm just not sure, you know, how they're going to overturn it. It's long gone. I think the next step would be let's institute more replays so that things like this don't happen again.
Well, a couple things. First of all, some people are saying that if they reverse this, then people might come out of the woodwork asking to have other things reviewed. You know, our producer, Alex Ashlock, says he wants the 1985 World Series Cardinals-Royals bad call that he feels cost the Cardinals the series reviewed. So that's one point. But, you know, you mentioned replays. Right now, only controversial home runs get a tape replay in baseball. So do you think they might expand that?
Well, certainly on the wake of this, there's going to be an outcry to do that. I don't think it will happen. And the reason I don't think it will happen is because, you know, it just will extend some of these games. And they're already pretty long. Then you have to decide, well, you know, what calls are we going to review? How are we going to do that?
Yeah.
I mean, if you start doing all that stuff, then it's going to take forever to play these games.
Right. How tough is this going to be from here on out for this umpire, Jim Joyce? I mean, even Galarraga said he felt sorry for him.
Oh, I think it's really hard for this guy. I mean, he'll always be remembered for this, as Don Denkinger was remembered for his call in the 85 World Series. So it's going to be with him for a long, long time. He's behind the plate today, actually. Which is going to be interesting to see how he reacts as the home plate umpire calling balls and strikes. I'm sure his head's not in the game after what happened. So it's going to be a very long haul for Jim Joyce, who's actually a pretty good umpire.
Well, and we just want to note, one of Galarraga's responses was he just shrugged and said, well, you know, nobody's perfect. But he almost was.
And he actually was.
Nick Cafardo, national baseball writer for the Boston Globe. Thanks so much.
Take care, Robin.
Did you see Zach Weinstein guest starring as Sean in a recent episode of the Fox sitcom Glee?
One love, one life, when it's one need in the night.
Zach landed the part of a football player paralyzed after an accident, and then landed in a bit of a controversy because Zach is paralyzed from the chest down, and another actor on the show, Kevin McHale, is able-bodied but has a recurring role as a character in a wheelchair. Zach Weinstein is from Needham, Massachusetts, but now lives in Hollywood. He joins us from there. And Zach, first, what was your response to the critics of this idea of an able-bodied actor playing the disabled character, Artie?
The way that I think about it, the character was written as a character who uses a wheelchair. And the producers, they auditioned people who use wheelchairs for that part. And they just thought that Kevin was the best actor for the role. They loved his voice. They loved his take on the character. They loved his look. And really, I think that the debate goes more to auditions and the casting process than the casting results. Obviously, you know, if everyone in Hollywood cast people who use wheelchairs for all those roles with people who use wheelchairs, you wouldn't be hearing any complaints. But I don't think that it's fair to require it of them.
No.
And as long as people with chairs are given equal opportunity to audition for those roles, and of course, I think for any role that it's conceivable that we could play, I think it goes both ways in that way as well.
Do you wish a little bit, though? Wow, I wish I'd auditioned for Artie.
Yeah, I definitely wish I had auditioned for Artie, but I don't know if I would have ended up getting the role. He's a really talented actor and a great, great singer.
Well, and you wanted this world acting long before you had your accident. Just tell us a little bit, hey, how'd this happen? It was a horsing around?
Yeah, the summer between my freshman and my sophomore year of college, I was working as a camp counselor at a summer camp in Maine, and a bunch of the counselors, we were on a day off, and we were canoeing down the Saco River in Maine, and, you know, a bunch of us stopped off to the side to take a break, and a friend and I were playing around in the water, and he flipped me up over his shoulders, and I hit the bottom of the river.
Just like that. Yeah. Well, how do you, as, you know, you take years to recover, you go back to Skidmore College, you pick up studies, but was there a thought of, well, there goes acting?
You know, if anything, for me, it kind of made my desire to make it happen stronger, because as cliche as it might sound, life really is too short to not go after what you love doing, and it's what I love doing, and it turns out that the opportunities are out there for me to do it at a pretty high level.
Do you have role models? Is there are there other wheelchair-bound actors you observe?
Christopher Reeve obviously was a huge role model. He was obviously a famous actor before he got injured, but I do work with the Christopher Reeve Foundation, and there's an actor named Daryl Mitchell who's awesome. He's the guy in the show Brothers, the sitcom Brothers.
There's also the actor Michael Patrick Thornton.
Right, yeah, and he's on private practice. He's great, and I really like what they're doing with his character.
Well, in the episode on Glee, you have a couple of scenes with the lead character, Rachel, played by Lea Michele. And mm-hmm. Now, in this in the show, she'd lost her voice. She had laryngitis, and she's really frustrated. And her friend brings her to you. You've just had this devastating football accident. Let's listen.
Are you trying to tell me that you're happier now?
Hell no. I'm miserable. I miss my body. I miss my life. I miss my friends. I miss girls. But I've realized over time that I've got other stuff going on. I'm more than just one thing. You know, I'm good at math. Seriously. I flew through Calc 1 in like 2 months. And I can sing.
Well, and that's the cue. I can sing, you know, on that show. But
yeah.
I'm wondering, Zach, how much of that is acting and how much of that is, I mean, it's a terrible thing to ask an actor.
That's fine. Yeah. Everything that I said was what they wrote, and they did a really great job with it. But the reason that the writing is so good is because it really does speak to my experience and other people in chairs who I've spoken with. They all say the same thing. They're like, yeah, that really reflects the experience. It's like, you know, are you saying that you've discovered some sort of deeper meaning to life? Well, sure, yeah, but anyone can discover that. It's like, well, no, this sucks. Can I say sucks? This sucks.
Yes.
But there are situations that people have in their lives that suck, and you find a way to take a handle of it, accept it, and move on, and continue living your life to the fullest capacity that you can. And with this injury, it's really possible.
Well, we're thinking there's one part of that script that may absolutely not resonate for you, which is the part about missing girls, because we understand your wife, Anna Maya.
Yeah, no, I'm doing all right with that.
Yeah, you two had been barely dating when this accident happened, and now she's your wife. But she really also rejects this notion that, you know, when people say, oh, what an angel, you know, through it all, she doesn't see herself that way.
Well, she just characterizes it as we just get along great, and we're in love, we love each other, and it's the relationship that we're having. So it has nothing to do with her taking pity on me or nursing me or taking care of me. We're in a relationship, we love each other, it's, you know, we're in this relationship together as equally as any other two people would be in a relationship together.
That's Zach Weinstein. He guest starred in a recent episode of the Fox sitcom Glee. Zach, we are looking forward to seeing what happens next.
Me too.